Because apparently in certain places you could get Thor, you know?
Uh-huh.
He told me I could not only get Thor, but I could get Quicksilver as well.
Uh-huh.
And it was the Mortal Kombat blood code with Quicksilver code scratched over Mortal Kombat code.
And it turned the spit into blood.
If there's anybody in the southeast of Ireland that sees a guy selling Marvel Ultimate Alliance to for the Mega Drive, just shoot him or something.
Very good. Hey, well, stay on the line, John, and we'll bring you in for the council, which I think is next. I'm not sure. It all depends on what Keith hooks me up with here. So, all right, hold on. Bye. Thanks.
See you later.
Bye. John E. Capcom. I'm feeling good. Still feeling good. Feeling alive. Comfortable. What's next, Keith? Oh, John Gibson's on the line? Okay, great. Yeah, you know what? Johnny Capcom always puts me in an 8-bit mood. I feel pixely right now. Let's go to IM. What do you got there, Stink? A birthday noisemaker?
What's it sound like?
That's great. That's what I got to put up with. Open the line, Keith. Los Angeles! John Gibson, you are 8-bit. Welcome to We Talk Games.
Hello?
Hello. How are you doing? Can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine. You're screaming.
Oh, yeah.
it's hard not to hear that.
Right. Now I am 8-bit. That's you. And just to draw our listeners in that aren't hip to all the going-ons of the internet and things like this, it's really amazing. It's lovely to see when a good idea becomes lucrative, because that's pretty rare, let's face it, doing your own thing and then it actually pays off. But briefly, in 2004, I guess it was, you decided to get some artist pals together to put on an exhibit of video game related artwork, and now after a few showings it actually has become a viable brand, and you're even tied into the video game industry.
You said it better than I could.
very good.
Yeah, it started as a little tiny germ of an idea to get a bunch of artist friends together and interpret all those awesome 80s video game icons into some sort of recontextualized craziness that we call I'm 8-bit. It's kind of the Toontown version of video games in a way, just like a bunch of characters coexisting in that awesome, cool era.
Right, right. Now, we'll get into little bits of it, hopefully, as we go on. But you didn't start out west. Where did you start?
I started in I was born in the wee little town of Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania.
Wilkes-Barre?
Which is not too far from it's not too far from the Dunder Mifflin, from the office where they're actually headquartered.
Yeah.
And then I moved to Michigan when I was about 4, and grew up there in the nice Midwest cold and in the humid summers.
Broadcasting.
And moved to California when I was 18.
Oh, I see. Well, we're broadcasting from the Lehigh Valley, so we're very many miles away from Wilkes-Barre, but close enough. Been there.
Yeah, cool.
Did you used to go to Knoebels Grove?
No. The only thing I really remember about Pennsylvania is Turkey Hills.
Okay.
I love to go to Turkey Hill and get the scratchers from the lady at the checkout counter. My grandpa would always take me. That's the most exciting story I have about Wilkes-Barre, beyond the fact that it's super, super ghetto now, and it's very easy to get raped or murdered walking down the street.
Hey, but, you know, that is a real-life adventure. You're renegade right on the streets there.
Yeah, it's your real-life Grand Theft Auto.
Where did you play video games as a youth?
There's a little place called My Basement that had a bunch of stuff from my older brothers, like an NES, Sega Master System. We had a Galaga machine, an actual coin-op that my dad got for, like, $50 or so. I don't even know where he got it. It just showed up one day.
Uh-huh.
Cool. And then a rat curled up in it and died and killed the board somehow. And none of us knew anything about power supplies or boards or any of that ridiculous tech jargon, so we just kind of let the machine sit there for years and do nothing. And then there's this little cool arcade called the Beehive in Michigan that we used to ride our bikes to. That sadly has closed down.
Sure. Well, hopefully they made a couple bucks off selling their black lights and strobe lights. So, well, now what took you out west? So keep going west and west. Why?
I stopped right before I hit the ocean. It was video game journalism, man. It was when I was in high school, I got fed up with the school newspaper and started submitting stories under the guise of being an actual real-life adult despite the fact that I was like 15, 16, and started writing video game reviews for the local news weeklies in Detroit, and then switched off to LA Weekly and started freelancing for like the men's mags. And my mom was pretending to be my secretary or personal assistant when she answered the phone.
So that's great.
There was this big ruse going on, and then I got a job offer to come out to LA.
Oh, and what company was that?
With a now defunct and very quickly defunct company upon moving out here called Gamers Republic. It was a video game magazine from the founder of GameFan. And I moved out, and then 2 months later, the magazine went out of business. And then a couple months later, we started Play Magazine. And then I stuck it out for about a year, then went freelance and started doing stuff for like Wired and Vanity Fair and FHM and Maxim and all sorts of other crazy outlets.
Oh, cool, cool.
Writing about video games and culture and all that awesome, fun stuff.
And you can live in California doing that. That's something.
Yeah, you know, it's... You gotta pick your grocery store that you shop at, though, because you can't afford the expensive fruit at Whole Foods. You gotta go to like Ralph's or one of the cheaper places.
Sure, sure.
You still gotta be cost conscious, but dude, you can live anywhere, writing and covering video games if you're savvy. I guess it's you just can't go to the clubs on the weekend and buy Dom Perignon. Like, you gotta be careful. You gotta avoid the excess.
Right on. Yeah, I guess you just buy a big slat of the pecan rolls at the good old BJ's wholesaler. You live off that for a week.
It's all about Costco and big, huge boxes of wine. That's all you need.
Right on. You know,
and Xbox Live. Yeah.
Oh, Xbox Live
subscription is important too.
So what happened with this? Now the exhibit. When did this all come together? How did this come about? Let's hear about this. This is interesting. This is great.
It was about 5 years ago now. I guess more like 5.5 years ago, the whole genesis of it, where I walked into a gallery and said, "Hey, I like art. I like video games. Let's do a show." And I'm announced to them, like I really was totally unfamiliar with the art world, and they had no general knowledge of video games beyond the fact that, they liked Pac-Man or Tapper or what have you.
Sure, sure.
So we just kind of joined forces and taught each other the ways of the system. And a year later, we had a crazy, insane art show that, some 1,200 people showed up at, and the line was crazy.
That's amazing.
It was one of those things you couldn't really anticipate. It was cool in our eyes. It was a bunch of people interpreting 80s. Video game icons and worlds and, this awesome, cool hybrid collage of things. And when you see a line of people nearly camped out waiting to get in, it's a pretty awesome sight.
Where did you pull the artists from? Were these just people you bumped into that you knew, or...?
It was kind of the genesis at the same time of places like MySpace. So, I had a lot of friends in animation because I was writing scripts for, like, Nickelodeon and Disney Channel and Cartoon Network and stuff. And, I knew a lot of artists, background guys, character designers, like a whole slew of dudes. And the gallery had, the resident, young guns that they were trying to promote. They were fairly new as a gallery to 1988 on Melrose in Hollywood. So everyone was like very young and hungry, but we also kind of combed the internet, the MySpaces of the world, and kind of clicked through links and ended up finding some very, very cool guys that now are pretty awesome and famous, but then were just dudes posting little JPEGs online and hoping people would take notice.
Right. If you go to WeTalkGames.com, that art is done by one of the artists of Flapjack, the Thaddeus Calderon.
Yeah, Flapjack is one of those awesome hybrid shows, too, that combines all the great mediums like stop motion and 2D animation. Tons of cool artists working on that.
And it's of Stinky and of TT, who are kind of... It's kind of a little awkward sitting between them this episode because of what happened last month, but we don't want to talk about it. Another thing that's very interesting about this is that you initially had the idea to have the artists just render what they thought they were seeing on screen back in the day of these simple blocky, pixely art deals, what they really thought they were seeing, how it made them feel. But a lot of the artists, it really didn't click with them, and this might have led to success, but I like where it is, and everyone can see this online somehow, I'm sure.
Yeah, if you type an IMAP into Google, a million things pop up. It's crazy, but Initially, the whole show was about your interpretation of these really archaic, really super limited things on screen. And it wasn't really a redesign contest either. It wasn't about, you know, just taking Mario and showing as Mario in your style. It was more about showing us Mario in your world of how you envisioned Mario existing, like, in that time. And, like, putting him in a scenario, like, putting him in things that are out of context, things that are kind of wild and crazy, perversions even, whether they be sexual or not. Taking these really limited personalities, these icons that are permeated but don't really have much functionality beyond the fact that, like, you know, Mario wears a red hat and he wears blue overalls and he says five different phrases and only has said five different phrases through his entire existence. So, like, he's got a mustache. He's, you know, he's got a brother named Luigi. Like, it's all these, like, really general bullet points of things.
Right.
And it leaves so much room for you to fill in the blanks, which is what's so awesome. And that's why, like, I feel if you were to take new games like a Tomb Raider or, a Master Chief or Crash Bandicoot or any of these characters, like, they're so incredibly developed.
Mm.
You're not going to really be able to present them in any sort of wildly interpretive light. Like, it's not as interesting.
Sure.
To see that stuff as art, because it's just so embellished already. It takes a lot more effort to present that in some sort of new capacity that you haven't seen yet. Everything's so highly rendered now, it's tough to have guys come in and really shed a new light on it.
Right.
Yeah, like, Mario continues to reinvent himself because they've kept him limited. Like, they've never really expanded beyond the horizons of, you know, those simple little traits.
And that's why he can fly around on a water gun, because you didn't know that he did that.
Yeah, you got Super Mario Galaxy, where he's in space jumping around planets and stars. You got Super Mario Sunshine, where he's just in a tropical island with some weird Ghostbusters pack and, yeah, crazy weird fire hose contraption. And Luigi's Mansion, like, they're kind of like Abbott and Costello in a way. They can be connected into any sort of scenario, like, which, I mean, all the great comedic actors of the world, like Chaplins and Bob Hopes and all these guys, you could just toss them into things because it wasn't necessarily a character they were playing. It was them. Like, they were the persona, and it was Charlie Chaplin in this new place. It wasn't Charlie Chaplin's character in this new place, necessarily.
Right.
Bob Hope, you know, same thing, like Abbott and Costello. It was Abbott and Costello. Like, it wasn't Abbott and Costello playing someone in every movie.
Right.
Like, you were familiar, and the brand was them. It wasn't the franchise of the movies, which is exactly how old-school games are. Like, and the guys who have maintained the franchises have made it work effectively.
Yeah.
And there's been a lot of things that have crashed and burned, too, because they've overcomplicated things.
Mm. Like,
it's got too messy.
Right on. Yeah, I can't wait till Mario and Luigi join the French Foreign Legion. That's going to be one of my favorite games.
Oh, man. That game's available, actually, like, overseas. It was a very limited run. It was a licensing deal gone sour. But.
And speaking of, you know who has a lot of room for development? Pong.
Exactly. You can totally add another ball and give them longer sticks.
Yeah.
And add a couple sound effects, and man, you got a whole movie on you. You got a whole franchise.
Yes.
Crazy.
Yeah, I liked seeing all the dongs on the 8-bit characters. That was very nice. Nice little touches like that.
It's funny how, in the context of the 8-bit show, how many artists don't go sexual right away. Like, it's really easy to do it.
Sure.
And, like, I definitely push against it unless it's a really creative version, or, you know, it's a really intelligent take on that. You know, just adding a dot to something and putting boobs on. So it's, you can get that on Google. That's easy.
Sure.
There's this really cool artist, Jude Buffum, who a couple years ago did 4 images, all pixel art, but interpreting Mario and Princess Peach and Bowser and Princess Zelda, all these kind of famous Nintendo characters in, like, weird sexual fantasies.
Right.
And in the context of pixels, it was even more interesting because you don't usually see that kind of thing. But it's kind of hard to describe, and it's much cooler to see. So if you Google Jude Buffum and type in IM8-bit, you'll probably find these pieces, and you'll get a good chuckle. They're very well conceived.
Very good.
He's a perverted, amazing artist.
Now, who was the first company or production or what have you to contact you to sort of start this push towards an actual brand, the I Am 8-Bit? I know that you did some work on King of Kong. Was that the first collaboration?
We've been kind of secretly doing a lot of things, and we still do a lot of projects that we don't effectively brand necessarily. Oh, okay. It really depends on the project itself, and if it can really benefit from our logo and whatnot. Like some things we do creatively because it's just an awesome gig, and we want to work on it, but it just makes sense to put our logo on something. It's not necessary. Like for instance, we just did a slew of stuff for BioWare for the Dragon Age Origins game that actually came out.
Okay, great.
Today. And we made this awesome little press kit mailer where we got this little wax seal made and got mana potions and disguised them as Darkspawn blood and included all these little wax sealed letters, daring journalists to drink this vial of red stuff, which effectively was an energy drink that does not taste very good at all, but it looks cool. It's in a little mana potion bottle. And they're in hand-burned boxes, and, it's stuffed with hay. Very cool presentation, and, you get your little review copy of the game, plus a little backstory letter. It's a very kind of a, like, story-based mailer, if you will. We try to contribute to the mythos of everything we work on. So it's not just a frivolous item that kind of gets passed out there, tchotchke, as they call them in the industry, where sure. It's not a branded letter opener or, t-shirt with a logo on it.
Right,
it's more
right.
about kind of analyzing the game or the thing we're working on and figuring out what can we do to better that and to kind of convey the essence of this thing without making it cheesy or hokey, like try to sell the experience. So,
right. It's not
the first big thing we did was Mega Man 9 for Capcom, where we created this key art for the game because it was a digital download title, Xbox Live and PS3, and WiiWare, where they didn't really have box covers. They weren't going to produce hard copies at all.
Mm-hmm.
But the lineage of Mega Man back in the day on the NES was it had one of the worst pieces of art in video game history.
Yeah.
It was the worst conceived piece of cover art probably ever.
Yeah. He's holding a gun.
Yeah, and it had. Yeah, he's holding a gun. It looks like it's on color pencil. It's just completely out of context of anything. Like, it's a real human dude. Proportionally, perspective-wise, everything about that piece is just awful.
Yeah.
But it was kind of part of the era, too. Like, there was a lot of really bad art that came from video games, and people were really trying to overemphasize the excitement in something that was really archaic and limited. So Capcom came to us and asked us if we could capture that essence effectively without making bad art, which is kind of a weird challenge. Like, we don't want it to look so bad that it's just ugly, but is it possible to achieve that while paying tribute but also making a cool piece? And so we made the key art. This amazing artist, Gerald De Jesus, did it up, a longtime friend who style fit this project also perfectly. And then we extended that into the whole idea of creating a physical prop for this non-boxed version of the game. Like, it's digital, so let's bring it back into the physical world. Like, let's really pay homage to the 80s gaming scene, like when you went to Toys R Us and saw an NES card for $70 in the showcase. So we made a fake box, we wrote copy for the back, like designed the whole thing out to really feel like an NES card package that you're buying at any number of Sears department store video game sections. And then we took old NES carts and gutted them and put little mini CDs inside, magnetized them, relabeled them, like went the whole full Monty on it. And fans reacted in a really awesome way. We even shrink wrapped it and price tagged it as if it was like in a bargain bin, like to kind of really convey the whole 80s vibe of things. Like, it was meant to be this, this thing of discovery. Like, one, it's memories that are harking back, but two, it's like, it's an experience of putting it up. It's like a cool process, and it looks like a normal cart. Then you split it open, and there's a CD inside with a bunch of cool artwork and stuff, too. But what we didn't realize the effect of it was, people didn't want to open it. People were terrified to even, like, break the shrink wrap seal. Like, there was this wild collector's market going on almost instantly when people saw that piece of art, and it just spurred out of control to the point where these things were that were originally just given to press and eventually sold on Capcom's online store for $50, started going for like $1,200 on eBay.
It's amazing.
Like everything was handcrafted, like everything was hand cut, like it was all produced with loving care. So it was really cool to see that happen, but it was also shocking. Like you don't really expect the community to react in such an awesome way. Like you can't really anticipate that. Like it's especially for a game that was a risk. It was Mega Man 9, not reinvented. It wasn't in 3D. It was literally built on the same architecture of the NES. It was old school, like wholly and truly. Like there was nothing innovative about it beyond the fact that it was another Mega Man game, as if it was released 20 years ago. So no one, including Capcom, thought it was going to sell as well as it did, let alone get the reaction it did.
You know, John, I think that's important, though, and I'm really glad about the success of Mega Man 9, because I think the reason that this is popular is not just because it's nostalgic. I mean, of course, you know, it has that effect on some people, the nostalgia. Some people probably come into your galleries, they don't even know anything about video games. Just to take in the artwork, take in the atmosphere, experience something new. But I think it's important and successful because that 8-bit, 16-bit, those pixels, that is a video game. You know, I know that we can experience, this looks so real, this looks amazing, and that's good, and that can still keep going as well. But a video game is more like these pixels moving around. So I'm very happy as well about the success of Mega Man 9. I'm glad that you were a big part of that, because just that Mega Man 9 artwork, I know just from my own experience when I first saw it, when I first heard about it and doing this show, that was a big deal. That was a big deal that you went there.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where no one had really done a press kit like that before. Mm. Like before we sat there and started thinking about, like, what could be special for this game? Usually press kits were branded T-shirts that they sent.
Keychain.
In one size only. The Hanes DPT is, like, itchy, awful, thick, cotton, you know, bold logo tees. Like, no one really wears those beyond, you know, jogging or sleeping in big. So to do something special and to do something on a budget that, like, you know, could be effectively sent out without breaking the bank was kind of a challenge. And now we're seeing a lot of it go on. Like, there's this kind of renaissance, if you will, some sort of revolution happening where people are realizing that, like, if you take pride in doing cool stuff, if you spend a little more money and really put effort into doing creative stuff, you're not only going to see more press come from it and more attention, but you're going to appease the people who buy your games. You're going to make them happy.
Sure.
Like, you're going to give them something that pays tribute to all these things that they love and adore. Like, and it comes from a fan perspective. It's like, I'm a huge Mega Man fan. Like, it was an opportunity of a lifetime in a way, just because that was one of the games that I really was obsessed with when I was growing up and continued to be throughout the years, like into the SNES era and beyond.
Very good.
It's one of those things where, like, any project we take on, it's something that we have to really like. If you take on something that just doesn't make sense for you personally, like, you're not going to have the passion for it. So,
sure.
Like, when we choose our marketing projects, it's always stuff that really makes sense for us. Like, stuff that isn't necessarily retro or, you know, in the context of, like, the 8-bit era, but just stuff that makes a fanboy get a...
Gotcha.
We're huge into the microscopic view of things, like really figuring out presentation and making things look really pristine and cool, like giving stuff character, you know? Like,
sure,
like
sure.
Telling a story with every element. And it got to a point, even with the Mega Man 9 kits, where the price tags we put on, the general conceit was, don't, you know, be really delicate with the price tags. You want to put them on like you hate your job. Like, you work at Walmart, and you've just worked 6 hours, you just got out of school.
That's great.
And you have to hold a price gun for, you know, 4 more hours before you get to go home.
Yeah.
And you've got to price 1,000 Mega Man 9 carts. Like, you hate your life. You're just going to, like, do it as fast as you can. Make it messy. And so some are upside down. There's you know, double tags, triple tags. There's quadruple layer tags. It's we bought an old price gun for that very reason.
Yeah.
To kind of... Like, it doesn't function as well as modern price guns do.
Sure.
Like, you've got to go back and really figure out what stuff looked like. You can't really emulate it. You got to use that stuff. Yeah. You got to find that old paper. You got to find that old technology.
Yeah, you're giving me bad flashbacks because I was actually old enough to work in that era. So I remember a Kmart in 1983 in the toy department. I wasn't very happy, so let's change the topic here. But that's amazing. That's fantastic. Now, will there be a video game of I Am 8-Bit?
There are things that we're working on. Not necessarily a game of I Am 8-Bit per se, but a series of productions that follow certain rules, certain aesthetics of the 8-Bit era. So not necessarily pixel games, not necessarily old school graphics by any sense, but you know, the general conceits of what the era was all about. Like, there's certain things I love about old games that new games never conquer, that never adhere to. Like, the idea of there never being an ending.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I love that old arcade games literally never give you a story-based ending. Like, it's all about skill, and it's all about earning that high score. Like, that's a beautiful thing that doesn't really exist anymore. Geometry Wars, a couple things have come out that have hit big, but, like, very few games really predicate themselves on that. We're working on stuff. Like, we'll see what happens in the next year or so. But,
turn it over, man. Turn it over. That's what it was all about back in the day when, hey, turn that game over.
It's cool, though, to see, like, WiiWare and Xbox Live, you know, like PlayStation Marketplace, all this stuff come to fruition. Like, it's now becoming viable to do something small. It's big. Like, 3-4 years ago, no one would have picked up a tiny little game. But now you see things like Pac-Man Championship Edition or Geometry Wars or any number of games that really do hit big, and they're minuscule in comparison to budgets for, like, the latest GTA. Like, sure, they're not spending $100 million on a game. They're spending a couple hundred grand with a couple dudes in a small office somewhere, and it's great to see things like Castle Crashers and Behemoth doing really cool stuff, like, on, you know, with small teams. It's weird to have such large productions without, like, the indie film scene, if you will.
Sure. To run parallel in the fun area and in the success area as well. It's a great time.
And finally they found an outlet where, like, they can actually be successful. It's not just passion projects anymore. Like, you can literally make something for nothing and make good money off of it. You can make a living. A couple years ago, that wasn't really possible.
What other ways is the brand progressing?
More and more we're doing these kind of corporate events that very much defy the corporate mentality, if you will. Like, it's not just the get in line and get an autograph. It's all about living and breathing that thing, like, that experience. So, like Street Fighter Club for Capcom, we orchestrated a bunch of events where they were literally like underground fight clubs in New York and L.A. where kids would come and enter into a really desolate, broke-down, you know, palace of debris, and amidst all the rubble was a bunch of Street Fighter 4 cabinets, and they walked away with lots of exclusive goodies, cool DJs, cool vibe, and for 4 hours, you are treated to a party for free. Like, all you gotta do is be a fan and show up. And that's what we're really trying to push, is the idea of community being a huge component of success of things in the industry. As much as it is film or music or anything, it's, you gotta support those hardcore fans. Like, you can't just expect them to always love you. Like, even though they probably will, like, you got to respect the fact that these guys are diehards, and, like, they're the ones that are going to spread the word. So you should share that stuff with them early. Like, you should really feed into that and give them exclusive cool stuff. Like, don't print 1,000 t-shirts, print 100 t-shirts. Do the things that are special for them. So, like, we always follow that caveat too, where if we're going to do an event, if we're going to do something special, it is going to remain special. It's not going to be something mass-produced, whether it's super popular or, you know, it falls flat. It's all about the limited edition aspect of it. It's all about that badge of honor, that I was there, I did this thing, I have this shirt. And if you see another person with that thing, like, it's almost like a high school reunion in a way. It's like, you were in so-and-so's class?
Mm-hmm.
It's a cool experience. Like, when you can go and buy something at Hot Topic, and you
and it's run over.
Into a guy with a fake vintage Journey t-shirt,
yeah,
it's not really as exciting as, you know, walking into a guy. Like, for instance, we were in New York a couple months ago, and walking around Dumbo in Brooklyn, right near the Brooklyn Bridge, and we literally saw a guy wearing a Street Fighter Club t-shirt from New York. And maybe 200 people came to that event, super, super, like, secretive, and the odds of us seeing one guy in Brooklyn that came to that thing, like, on the street, like, on any given day was pretty amazing. And we just kind of, like shouted, like, Street Fighter Club, and he shouted back, and then we just kept walking. But it's those moments that are really cool. Like,
sure.
Those are the things that, like, make us happy.
Right on, man. Hey, well, I'm delighted for your success. It's really, really great. And thank you so very much for taking the time to come on and talk to the little guys here at We Talk Games.
I'm pregnant.
Oh, what? Wait a minute. Hey,
I'm pregnant from making out.
All we did was kiss.
Uh-oh, John, yeah, I'm sorry. I got to go because this is a bombshell. T.T. Schmutkins here.
That sounds like a
I guess you're not very educated in robot physiology.
I guess not. But,
yeah. You have some Planned Parenthood meetings to attend.
This isn't going to be good, I'll tell you that.
I'll have my lawyer contact your lawyer.
I don't even have a lawyer. Have him contact my rabbi.
All right. Hey, John, thank you so much for being a part of this. Much, much more success. And we'll have to get together and run down the list of artists we might know from California there and see if any of them line up.
I think there's some connections here.
Some of our Kubert pals.
Oh, yeah, man. Well, thank you again. This is fun.
Right on, man. Bye now.
All right. Later, man. Adios.
All right, TT, what's this all about here? Did you know about this, Stinky?
What do you mean, did I know? I don't know, man. I kissed her.
Don't tell Kyle.
Don't tell Kyle? Where are you going?
I'm out of here, losers.
Hey.
I'm gonna go, too.
I just don't have the energy to... I can't chase people down. We gotta... What are we doing now? Council... All right, Keith, get Kyle and, who I won't tell, I don't know why, get Kyle and John back on the line. We're going to just go and compose myself. Wait a second. Let me compose myself.